I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A study just published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, took a look at parent-infant communication involving electronic toys, traditional toys, and books. Researchers found that when e-toys were involved, there was less verbal interaction between parent and child compared to the other toys. We asked the lead researcher on this study to join us. Anna Sosa is an associate professor of communication sciences and disorders at Northern Arizona University, where she's also director of the NAU Child Speech and Language Lab. Her research focuses on early speech and language development in infants, toddlers, and preschoolers. Anna Sosa, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us and here with us in our Philadelphia studio, someone we call on from time to time when we talk about children and language, is Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. She is the Lefkowitz Faculty Fellow in the Psychology Department at Temple University, also a Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. And Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. And I do want to begin with you. What were you looking to understand in doing this study?
Really, I just wanted to see how different everyday interactions that parents and babies occur, how that influences the communication between the parents and the babies.
And we're talking about three sets of toys. What were the toys that were part of this experiment?
Right. So to start looking at this, I chose toys. There's obviously lots of different everyday activities that occur, but we decided to focus on toys to start with. And so we decided to look at electronic toys. So these are toys that light up or beep or flash or make noises when a child pushes a button. We wanted to see what parents and babies did in interaction with those toys versus traditional toys. I'm calling traditional toys things like blocks. We use stacking blocks, shape sorters, and big chunky puzzles that are designed for babies in this age. And then I was also curious about how using books, reading with babies, compares to these different types of toys, since parents of, you know, infants from birth are often encouraged to read to their infants. So I was interested to see how these different interactions compared.
And how old were the babies in this study?
So at the time of data collection, the babies were between 10 and 16 months.
And interestingly, this was research that was done in the home in 15-minute increments, and there were audio recordings. So that it wasn't that you were observing these people. You were actually listening, I guess, to the audio recordings.
Exactly. So we only had the audio recording to go on, so we could really only analyze the verbal interactions. There's a lot of other stuff, nonverbal, going on that we weren't able to look at. But we did record in the home, and we really wanted to do that to try and make it more naturalistic to see when parents and babies are playing in their usual setting with the usual distractions, dogs in the background, other siblings coming and going. What's going on during those times as opposed to in a more observed laboratory setting.
And what did you find?
Really consistent results, which is what I was surprised about. So in general, the parents talked a lot more. We were really looking more at what the parents were doing than what the babies were doing. So we were focusing on the language input and the verbal behavior that the babies were getting from their parents. And we found across the board that the play with the electronic toys resulted in decreased numbers of words, just in general. We also looked at different types of words. So we selected toys in all the categories that were designed to elicit words in specific categories. So we looked at toys that could elicit animal names, colors, and shapes. And so we counted how many times a parent actually said one of those words. So did they say, oh, look, there's a piggy, or it's red? And again, in the electronic toy condition, they produced a lot fewer of those types of words.
So that's the main takeaway, that when looking at these three categories of toys, when it involves an electronic toy, there are less words coming out of the parent's mouth.
So the strongest findings were in the quantity measures. I'm very strong as far as just across the board, how many more words the parents were producing in the books. And I should say that we also were interested in the differences between books and traditional toys. So are books that much better than traditional toys? And in some of the quantitative measures, there were big differences between the traditional toys and the books. We also looked at some more qualitative measures of the parent-child interaction, so how responsive the parent was to the baby. So most of these babies were not actually producing words. They're in the pre-linguistic. They're babbling. And so we were looking at when a baby did vocalize or babble, did the parent respond contingently to them? And again, we only could listen for verbal responses, not nonverbal responses. And we found that in the book and traditional play conditions, they were more responsive to their baby's verbalizations or vocalizations than they were in the electronic toy condition also.
Kathy, let me get you in on the conversation.
Well, hi, guys.
Any surprises here from these findings?
No, it's a lovely study. Congratulations. That was really, really nice. No, we actually have research that's fairly consistent with this. One was with the electronic shape sorters, and Jen Zosh was the lead author on this paper, and we watched as parents were with their children trying to fit the squares in the square hole and the triangles in the triangle hole. And what did we find when you looked at traditional shape sorters versus, you know, these electronic, more digital, is that the toy is always talking for you and it's taking over in the conversation. We actually, in that study, did not see a difference in the amount of language, but in the kind of language.
How so?
So what happens is the parents tend to either not say the names of the shapes, which is very consistent, because why should they? The toy's already saying shape. We're saying square. So why bother taking over for the toy when it's blabbing? But more importantly, the parents were more directive and less conversational. So they would say, put that here, shove it into this hole, instead of asking more questions. Well, where do you think this goes? Hmm. We found very similar findings when we looked at children reading. So there it's quite consistent again. When you have an electronic kind of book, the parents are talking less and they're giving more commands. Don't push that. Turn the page, as opposed to really going beyond the words in the book to create a conversation.
And is that because maybe from the parents' perspective, I mean, a child that's 10 months old doesn't really have an opinion about an e-book or a regular book. From the parents' perspective, they see this device or this toy, in a sense, doing their job for them?
Well, in our studies, the children were 3 and 4.
A little older.
So they were a little bit older, and that does make a difference. So, you know, the parents could have a choice. And I think in our minds as parents sometimes, we do let the toys substitute for what we're going to do instead of supplementing what we're doing with the toy and with the child.
But let's take a pile of blocks. I mean, should parents be talking with their children about how to build a wall or just let the child figure this out? I realize we're talking many ways about language development, but does that mean a parent has to talk to their child through every toy activity?
Well, no, a parent doesn't have to speak with a child all the time, nor does a toy. And I think the point here is to try to create situations where parents and children have conversations. And let's take your block example.
Sure.
Because we actually had a study on that as well. And when you have parents and children playing with blocks, when the kid is playing alone, they do beautiful things, and free play alone is really important, especially in a digital world that we live in. But when the parent's around and doing the supplement, not substitute, and not intruding, they actually, with blocks, use more spatial terms, like put the blue one on top of the red. Or can you make this go through this? Or let's turn the yellow one. And when you use those kinds of terms like around, through, in, out, middle, you're actually building spatial information. And it turns out that spatial knowledge is not only important for later architects, but also for later mathematicians.
Oh, interesting. Anna, let me go back to you, because looking at even the title of your study has to do with what you talk about is the quantity and also the quality of this parent-infant communication. What is the takeaway from your study then?
Well, I should start with what my motivation for doing the study was, which is I am a speech-language pathologist and I work with families of young children, children as young as 10 months who have communication disorders or are at risk for. And I, about 3 years ago, I actually had a family ask me, say, you know, I've seen these toys that are advertised as teaching language to babies this young, and should I buy them? Should I have these available for my child? Will this help? And yeah, certainly I had my, you know, my instinct of what I wanted to say.
Sure.
I didn't have a lot of evidence to base it on. And subsequently, I had a student, a former student, call and pretty much ask me the same thing that a parent had asked her. She was working in early intervention. And I said, you know what, I want to know, what is the difference? What do parents do in this interaction? What types of interactions build the most, you know, the optimal language interaction? And based on the results of the study, my takeaway is I can now safely tell that parent, or confidently tell that parent, don't bother. Don't buy those toys. The time that you do have available to spend one-on-one playing with your child, focus on other types of interactions. And I can recommend traditional toys, blocks, things like that. And on the other hand, I've also had parents of very young babies or very young toddlers say, I've heard over and over again, I need to read to my child. I should be reading to my child. But for whatever reason, either they're not comfortable with it or their child doesn't particularly enjoy that activity at this age. They crawl away, they'll spend a couple minutes, but then they're not interested. I feel I can now confidently tell those parents, play with blocks. If they're not interested in reading, do a little bit of that, and then feel comfortable that you can provide a wonderful quality language interaction playing with blocks and other types of toys also.
Kathy, let me go back to you. I know the American Academy of Pediatrics said no screen time until for children under the age of two. But I have seen toddlers, and they see their mom or dad's cell phone, and their face lights up. We have about a minute before our first break here. What do you suggest to a parent?
Oh, Marty, it's such digital candy.
But of course, digital candy.
Our children are very attracted to dessert, too, and we don't let them eat the dessert instead of having the nutritious meal. So, you know, let's just look at the numbers for one sec. 70% of children 0 to 4 now have a tablet. 50% of children under 1 are playing with the tablet every day. 65% of parents are using some of these as babysitters. As parents, I think we just have to find the balance. It's not that these things are horrible. They have many wonderful features. But we also have to be careful how we use it. The same way we have to be careful with dessert.
And also, going back to Anna's study, sort of understanding perhaps maybe even listening to oneself, how one interacts with a child when there are different kinds of toys.
Well, it's all about the conversational duet, the back and forth, the singing it together. That's what breeds good language.
And that is Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. She's a faculty fellow, the Lefkowitz Faculty Fellow in the Psychology Department at Temple University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Also with us, Anna Sosa, director of the NAU, that's the Northern Arizona University Child Speech and Language Lab. And we've been talking about a study she did looking at children and different kinds of toys published in JAMA. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. In this hour of the show, we are talking about children, language acquisition, toys, the roles that parents play, the role that toys play as well. And again, our guests are Anna Sosa and Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Kathy, just a slight correction. I want you to make something I said that was not exactly correct, and we like to be correct on Radio Times.
All right, you got it.
It's important.
Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics did do a revision. Look, we live in a digital world. When you're at a point that 3/4 of children 0 to 4 have tablets, I think you have to get to the reality, as it were, that we're living digital. So now they're recommending balance as opposed to an absolute no screen time before 2.
And balance, I mean, that can mean different things to different people.
Yeah, well, it can. And I don't know that there really is an absolute. And right now I think we're living in the kind of wild west of the digital times where people are putting out new products constantly. And I think that we'll come to a point, as we did in educational television, where we'll better understand how we can substitute what we do and supplement what we do with digital as opposed to substituting or getting fixated on it.
Speaking of educational television, I'm thinking of Sesame Street, and this feels almost old-fashioned, you know, in the days
of apps
and cell phones. But nonetheless, to you, Anna, is this sort of along the same lines as television? I'm thinking of, you know, Teletubbies, Sesame Street, and some of the other so-called educational programs on public television. Are the findings applicable when it comes to television?
I'm not sure that they are directly applicable, because this was, you know, really asking the parents to sit down with their child and play one-on-one. So this is sort of the optimum playtime or experience that is recommended by the American Academy of Pediatricians and such, that, you know, we should spend as much time as possible playing. And so this isn't... the study wasn't looking at just letting the child play independently with various types of toys, but really even in the sort of optimal child parent down on the floor playing with the child, what are the parents doing?
Such an important question. And Kathy, another thing that you are an expert in is the importance of play for children. I mean, I guess, what, imaginative play? You mentioned the blocks, the importance of what you can learn from building blocks.
Well, there's just a lot that you can learn from different kinds of play, and there are many different kinds of play. You know, object play when we're playing with blocks, or when we put on masks and we become Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader, we're doing a kind of pretend play. And there we learn to take on different roles, and we learn social skills. So sometimes free play is just great for free play, because we're trying to figure out how high we can build a tower before it falls down. We're being little physicists. And sometimes play can be more guided with adults. And with that, the child still takes the lead. Mm-hmm. But the adult is there in a supporting role. And when that happens, you do get a lot of rich language. I mean, Anna and I are totally kindred spirits here.
Well, and language, I mean, what you're also talking about is a conversation. I mean, even with a pre-verbal child, a conversation.
Yeah. Believe it or not, even pre-verbal children smile and coo and burp. And you wouldn't believe this. Well, Anna would. But you put an eight-week-old in front of the two of us, and I promised that Anna and I would have a conversation. And you can actually have those conversations, but you have to take the time to look into the fire in their eyes as they're figuring it out. And a conversation isn't a one-way street. It's a back and forth. And it means letting the child speak, and then you speak, and back and back. And that's why we call it conversational duets. And it turns out that what lives in those conversational duets is the beginning and the basis for language learning.
And for relationships.
And
too.
For relationships.
Anna, you want to weigh in on that?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, in this study, with the babies being so young, most of them pre-verbal, it's this back and forth and verbal responsiveness, contingent responsiveness on the part of the parents that we know keeps the child in an interaction with their caregiver, which builds that language skill. They babble more. That babble is gradually melded into words as they develop. And so this age, particularly starting at about 10 months, when babies are starting to communicate intentionally, we know that the more that a parent hears that attempt, whatever it sounds like, responds to that attempt, and in some ways starts to shape it into actual words.
Mm. Like almost like mimicking what the child is doing, Anna?
Absolutely. So that's one of the things. So if our goal is to get babies to vocalize more, pre-verbal babies are pretty quiet, and we want to get them to start vocalizing more, babbling more. One of the main things we tell parents is to imitate your baby. So if they say, ah, say, ah, back to them. And it's amazing how wonderful the child thinks that is. They just perk up and they'll say something back to you. And so imitation is one of the main strategies I use with parents of children who are at risk for communication disorders.
Go ahead, Kathy. It looks like you want to add something.
Yeah, just that you know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, we grow language. It's sort of like the water of language for the plant of language. Is this back and forth where we're sensitive to the person with whom we're speaking? And we find that across the dinner table, too. Let me just give you an example of where it's broken. All right, when you're sitting with your friend and your friend decides to look down to see if they've gotten any text messages, all right, now there's a case where you're breaking the kind of back and forth or contingency or duet that you've been singing together over the dinner table. And if you think we're aware of it, let me tell you how aware of it young children are. We've just finished a study where we're looking at parents while they're speaking with their children, and we ask them to take our cell phone call. And then we find out what happens when the parents do take that call as opposed to when they don't. And it's fascinating. It's as if the entire relationship suspends for a moment. And the children don't learn as much. They're deeply sensitive to breaks in the conversation, just like they grow when you have the back and forth.
Are they angry at their parents for breaking this conversation and duet?
Well, sometimes they are. In one case, we had a really wonderful situation where the parent was just the best parent ever. And of course, remember, we asked this woman to pick up the cell phone, and she does, and she's talking to us, and she's polite, looking a glance at her child. And the child takes some object in our lab and starts banging the head of the baby that's in front of the mom. Not the real baby.
Yes.
The fake baby.
Yes.
But you can just see they get very frustrated. So as important as it is when we have it, it's super important when we break those contingencies. These toys are getting in the way.
Let me get, looks like Payush from Princeton to join us on Radio Times. And Payush, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty. I
sure.
really appreciate you taking the call. And
sure.
I also wanted to thank you for choosing relevant topics. I'm a parent of a 24-month baby, and he's the younger of the three children. And I wanted to find out, I know the study was done with younger children, and I just wanted to see if your experts believe the findings are just as relevant for 24-month-old baby. He's significantly delayed in his speech, and we're working with him, but I wonder if we should just shut off the television, shut off all other aid, and really start focusing on basic toys, basic colors of reading, et cetera.
Sure, Payush. Let me see what Anna Sosa says, and then Kathy Hirsch-Pasek.
I mean, I think for a child, for any child, but particularly for a child with developmental delay and communication delay, as much of that interaction as possible is absolutely what's going to grow that child's language. Now, should we go, you know, completely, absolutely no screens whatsoever? I don't think that's realistic in this world, especially for a 24-month-old at this point. But I think understanding that that is not where the child is going to learn language. So that may be a break. That may be a fun thing that the child can do for a few minutes while mom and dad need to get something done. But even though perhaps the program is marketed as educational or the toy is marketed as educational, that's not where the child is going to learn language.
Go ahead, Kathy.
Yeah, very little to add. I just think that we should always watch out for those things that are labeled educational, or I just call them so-called educational. Most of them are not. My favorite example of that is a product called Your Baby Can Read, to which we respond, no, she can't.
Oh.
And there's actually research by Susan Newman showing that, what? This is just a little bit bogus.
I mean, are there criteria for silly question here, for advertising, you know, truth in advertising? But if we're talking about children, I realize we sell, you know, terrible cereals to them. But if we're talking about children, are there any criteria, Kathy, for that?
No, actually, there are not. Anything you want to post up there and call it an educational app or an educational toy is perfectly fine. You can put ABCs on the back of a little rocker for a child and say it's an educational chair. And while that sounds ridiculous, that's what people are doing. We recently wrote a piece, which is actually downloadable, called Putting the Education Back in Educational Apps. And we offer a series of criteria that parents can use. If something is active as opposed to passive, if it's engaging as opposed to distracting, which a lot of these toys are that Anna looked at, if it allows for a meaningful exchange, makes sense, and if it's socially interactive, again, here you come back to that conversational duet. Those are criteria that are better for educational learning, sort of educational, not in school but out of school, than those things that are not.
I remember, was it Baby Einstein? I don't know where that stands today. Oh, my. I mean, where that stands today. But I remember, I've been doing this so long, I remember that was the rage. And, you expose your child to Einstein or to Mozart, and voila.
Yeah, well, Susan Lin from Harvard's been sort of a watchdog, and just fabulously examining whether these things are good for kids. And she's the one who brought up the Baby Einstein case. And in fact, I think Disney offered refunds for those who had bought Baby Einstein.
Anna, sounds like you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that as Kathy was talking, I was thinking of the Baby Einstein example in terms of the marketing as educational. I think parents should be cautious because not only can companies say whatever they want, but sometimes they take existing research that is good research and use it in a way that is not accurate to promote the advantages of their product. And Baby Einstein was one example when they used some speech perception research that had been done and said you need to expose your baby to foreign languages if they're ever going to learn a foreign language and have them watch these videos of Mandarin. And we've since learned that babies aren't going to learn what they are supposedly going to learn from videos of Mandarin.
Well, we are talking about babies, children learning language, the use of toys. A little bit later, we'll be talking about the role of nature and having kindergarten kids playing outside essentially all day long. But in the meantime, talking with Anna Sosa from Northern Arizona University, Kathy Hirsch-Pasek from Temple University. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We did a show a couple of years ago on this, but it's also, and I'll put this to you, Anna, since you work with children with perhaps delayed speech, but also the fact that for some kids in this country, some low-income kids in this country, they literally are exposed to many fewer words than their more middle-class counterparts. Is that something, Anna, you've looked at?
I have not specifically looked at that myself, but it's certainly something that we're all familiar with, the studies that have found this result over and over again, both in quantity and in quality of communicative interactions. And so this is putting kids at a disadvantage when it comes to language development and later academic achievement. And what I think there are some numbers that show that actually lower socioeconomic families are more likely to buy some of these electronic toys that do have bells and whistles than higher socioeconomic families. And I think this is now kind of a double whammy. If they're more likely to buy these toys, that even when they do have the time to interact with their child may reduce the quantity and quality of the interaction.
You want to add to that, Kathy?
Well, yeah, just two things. One is that I just want to put up front that every parent wants to be the very best parent for her child.
No question.
And so sometimes if they believe that these toys are going to help out or offer the kind of language that the child needs, then they will make the sacrifice and they will buy the toy. I also just want to add one piece to the 30 million word gap story, which is a study that we did that came out last year. Year,
right.
And look not just at the quantity of the speech, but also at the quality. And I think that's what Anna is talking about as well. And it gets back to that conversational duet, but an important point. We looked in that study just at low-income families. And even when you look within low-income families, you find some parents who are singing the conversational duet and some who are not. So rather than viewing this as a middle-income versus a lower-income have different levels of language, though that is a tendency within the literature, I'd rather we just say that there are different kinds of styles, some of which really do assist in language learning and some which seem to stop it in its tracks.
I think that's a very good point. Let me get Warren from, looks like Westchester to join us. Warren, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate it.
Sure.
I'm really enjoying this program this morning.
Thank you.
My question isn't so much about language specifically. I have a 21-month-old, and she seems to be progressing normally with language. But we do use TV a little bit as both a babysitter and sort of a routine, you know, wake-up routine with Sesame Street kind of a thing. And I'm curious, you guys were talking about TV a little while ago. I'm curious if you guys have any insight as to the effects of the TV. Like, I've heard things about ADHD or autism as it relates to too much television.
Well, Warren, let me put Kathy on, because she just had such a reaction to what you just said. Go ahead, Kathy.
No, there's really no credible work out there that suggests that television leads to ADHD or that television is leading to autism. Surely not autism.
Yeah.
So that I think it can be safe on. And I don't know a parent who doesn't need a break every so often. I know I did. I needed to take a shower. And so I think that's part of why the American Academy of Pediatrics moved to revise its criteria in 2015 and to talk about balance. So I think you're safe with your morning routine. I wouldn't really worry about it. But again, we have to be careful. And I keep bringing up the supplement versus substitute. You know, when we use things as a babysitter, when we think that they're getting quality language from television, at least in the 3 and under crowd, there is zero evidence that they are learning anything from televised displays. They're passive. They're not interactive. So know that you're doing a babysitter, and that's fine.
And a final words from you?
I would agree absolutely with Kathy's response to that.
Just a very quick, we have a tweet from Sunfire saying about the use of baby sign language. Do you have a position on that, Anna? in 20 seconds?
I don't know if I can do it in 20 seconds. I actually did a study on baby sign language many years ago. I don't think it harms in any way. I don't think we have credible evidence that it helps. There's been some studies that talk about intellectual benefits. I don't think those are there. And I've seen some parents who tend to reject verbal attempts when they're really concentrating on sign language, and I would discourage that.
Well, Anna Sosa, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Director of the Northern Arizona University Child Speech and Language Lab. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been talking about children and language acquisition. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek has been our guest. She's the Lefkowitz Faculty Fellow in the Psychology Department at Temple University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And now we want to go outside, and joining us is Gail Farmer. She's Director of Education at the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education. She's been an environmental educator for about 15 years now. And we wanted her to join us because we saw an article recently about some of these preschools or even kindergartens where children are outside pretty much all day long learning and living in nature. So, Gail Farmer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. So tell us a little bit about this environmental education program, how it works at the Schuylkill Center.
Okay, sure. So the Schuylkill Center is in Northwest Philadelphia, the Roxborough section of Philadelphia. We've been around for 50 years. And in September 2013, we opened our first nature preschool classroom. And we started with one class. And basically, it's a preschool. It's a mixed-age preschool for 3 to 5-year-olds. And the basic context for learning is the natural world. So the kids spend you know, most of their time outdoors every day.
Are they outside today when it's about 18 degrees out?
And I'm sure they are. They're all bundled up. Yep. They've got their hats, their gloves, their winter coats, their scarves, and they're outside. And really what we find is the kids don't mind the cold or the hot weather as much as the adults do.
Oh, that's interesting. I ran across a quote saying that there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothing.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So what do you think? I don't know if this is like a new trend or, you know, happening here and there, Kathy, but this idea of getting kids, I mean, some of these children spend all day outside in a preschool or kindergarten program. It might be raining, it might be freezing cold, it might be snowing, but they're outside.
Well, you know, long before there were iPads and iPhones, there were trees.
Exactly.
And there's really such richness in the outside world. So I think this trend, which, you know, it's not really new if it's 50 years old in Philadelphia, but I do think that more people are waking up to the idea that children have lost opportunities to play and to be outside. And so I'm thrilled this is coming back into vogue.
And I'm curious about Gail, for instance, today. It's Tuesday. So what are the children doing today? Do you know?
Well, I'm not sure exactly where they're going. So we have three classrooms now. In each of the groups, you know, they come in. They have some free time. There's some invitations set out in the classroom. In the cold weather, we usually start in the classroom. They have a little morning meeting. Then they start their process of bundling up.
It can take a while
until they get practiced at it. And then what we find is after, you know, a few weeks into the winter, they get good at it, you know, and they can get bundled up much more quickly. And then they head out to the trails. And they have some, you know, each of the groups have favorite spots where they like to go on our property. And they spend time engaged in free play. So our preschool is very much focused on child-directed free play as the primary vehicle for learning.
And what do you find a typical three-year-old does given time for free play?
Well, it's highly variable from child to child and from day to day and space to space. But, you know, I'd say that the things that are most compelling universally to the kids are sticks, rocks, dirt, and water. I mean, that's really all it takes to create a really meaningful, high-impact learning experience for kids.
Sticks and rocks.
Sticks and rocks. They're pretty amazing. You know, I was just thinking about some of the learning opportunities in what you're doing. You know, leaves are for sorting, right? And we can learn categorization that way. Trails are for learning spatial knowledge and maps and for navigating so you can get around outside. Rocks are teaching us physics. There is a mini caveat here that I just want to put out, which is that I think as we develop the sort of pedagogical approaches, the way we teach in some of these schools, we need to also think about free play versus what we've called guided play. Because it turns out that young children are learning in free play, but they aren't necessarily getting to a particular learning goal. And so much of our research has shown that if you have a learning goal in mind, and you may not, that the guided play where the child takes the lead role but where the adult helps to constrain the opportunities, kind of like in a Montessori environment to just give us a marker, that the children learn even more with our support roles. That is, if you draw attention, as it were, to the different types of leaves, the children are much more likely to notice the different shapes of those leaves than they are if they're just out there romping in them.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would just agree completely and say, you know, like our teachers, you know, really see themselves as facilitators and guides, and they're asking questions of the children really to deepen, you know, the children's interest is what drives what they're doing. And then the role of the teachers is to help deepen that experience and maybe guide it a bit through questions and provocations.
Exactly.
Well, and I'm also thinking, I mean, I think it's frankly terrific that there are these schools. I wish I had gone or had been able to send my child to a place where basically they are outdoors all day.
I'm enrolling now.
Well, which reason? I mean, we can play through life, can we not, Kathy?
Why not?
Really, it doesn't have to just be children. But I'm thinking about how parents can incorporate this stuff. And you know, not all parents want to send their children outside. They live in sometimes neighborhoods where it's not the safe thing to do. But to sort of incorporate what they're doing at a place like this and incorporating into a child's life at home?
Oh, you know, the home, the outside, the yard, they're so ripe with possibilities. Sometimes we just don't see them. I remember one day I was invited as part of a Discovery Channel thing to walk into a home where the mother was having tremendous problems because she couldn't cook dinner. And the child was disrupting the cooking of dinner every day. And so what I suggested is, well, let's look at the kitchen differently. Let's now think of the kitchen as an opportunity for the child to partake in the cooking with you. Now, she's not really going to cook as a three-year-old, but she can sure have a wooden spoon, and she can sure have a pot. And the minute the child started working with mom instead of working against mom or dad in that kitchen, voila. The child was not disruptive anymore. So we just need to change the lens on how we see the everyday environment and see it as particularly ripe with learning potential everywhere.
I have to ask you the academic question, Gail. As you say, 3 to 5 year olds, do you find that the 5 year olds have the skills, you know, to make it in a kindergarten or a first grade?
Right. So, you know, when we started the preschool, one of the most common questions we got from parents was about, quote unquote, kindergarten readiness. Right. You know, is this going to prepare my kids for kindergarten? And, you know, I really see that as an opportunity to talk with parents about, well, what is kindergarten readiness? What does it mean for a 5-year-old to be prepared for kindergarten? Is it what's more important? Is it knowing ABCs, 1, 2, 3s? Or is it about sort of the foundations of learning and being able to regulate your emotions, impulse control, social emotional capacity? And our program focuses very much, and I think the outdoors, in fact, provides a great context for children to learn about, collaborative play, problem solving, creative problem solving. There's a lot of research that supports how nature improves attention, focus, impulse control. So they get a lot of practice and experience in engaging in those types of skills and developmental milestones.
Do they know their ABCs?
Some do, some don't. My own child, in fact, who went to the nature preschool, was just not interested. I mean, he had lots of fine motor opportunities to practice, you know, holding pencils and holding sticks and things like that, that are the foundations ultimately towards writing. But he had zero interest in actually writing anything. And that was fine with me. And I knew, I trusted that when he was ready and when he was interested and driven internally, that he would get there. And he's in third grade now, and he's fine. He can write like everyone else.
Go ahead, Kathy.
So I'm gonna mostly agree and just have a mini caveat, because I do think today we understand that the very skills that you're speaking about are the ones that are going to help children grow the most. I mean, if you're more interested in something, you're going to be a better learner. You're going to stay on it longer, and you're going to have a passion, because today it's about lifelong learning.
Yes.
Not just learning in the moment. However, let's get to those skills just once more. Where there is a huge gap in at least the United States and in England and many countries around the world is with low-income children and middle-income children. And in many low-income homes, they have 10% of the homes have fewer than 10 age-appropriate books. Now, if you happen to come from a place where you can't go home to somebody who will read to you, or where you don't have books and you don't have puzzles and you don't have the other things that other children take for granted, then we do have to have environments that are going to allow for that exposure.
Because, yes, I mean, does that make sense to you, Gail?
Oh, absolutely. And certainly, you know, a nature preschool type of experience, they do incorporate, you know, literacy, skill development. We do reading every day. They do engage in those sort of foundational science, math, and literacy skill development, for sure.
And that's Gail Farmer, Director of Education at the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education. We asked her to join us to talk about what has been described as nature preschools and some interesting articles recently about these preschools. And Kathy Hirsch-Pasek with us as well. And she's a Temple University psychology professor and an authority on language and children and play. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Christy, and Kathy, I think this is kind of left over from our last conversation. Please ask your guests about the value of technology use in elementary school. Many schools tout one iPad per child as an academic advantage. Is there really any educational value to iPads in the classroom, especially in the early grades?
Well, it's not about the iPad. It's about what's on it. And today, I think we have really a proliferation of apps and devices. In fact, there are over 80,000 so-called educational apps available on your iTunes store. So the question is, what are really educational and which are not? And I think we're trying to get a better handle on that. I think once we do, for sure, these can be an important addition to taking us around the world. Google Maps have allowed us to see things that we never could have seen from the classroom before. However, if all it is a digital workbook,
No, I'm saying no. That has to be sort of exist in and of itself as opposed to just mimicking something else.
Adding to what we're doing.
Gail, do you have a position on things like that?
I pretty much agree with Kathy. I mean, I think, right, it's what's on the iPad. I'm not, as a nature lover in some way, I'm not anti-technology. And I do think it has its place and it has, its use if you're selective in how you use them. But I would love to comment on some of the ways I think that nature really benefits children in their development. Some benefits that you can get in a nature preschool type of experience that you can't really get in a classroom type of experience. And, you know, the research, there's a lot of research that demonstrates quite clearly that our brains are highly responsive to the natural world. And that's so as a result of direct contact with nature, you know, our stress levels go down, our moods are elevated, our immune system is boosted, our attention and focus improve, our impulse controls improve, our creativity improves. So there's, you know, nature is really our minds evolved in the natural world. And while our bodies are in the 21st century, our minds are still in the Pleistocene. And I think it's really important to sort of remember that context when we think about what is the optimal environment for child development, human development. You know, the play instinct drives children towards behaviors that are optimal for their brain development. And I think, you know, that children's affinity towards nature drives them towards the environment that's optimal, that sort of the optimal environment for development.
Go ahead, Kathy. Looks like you want to say something.
I agree that it's fabulous to be in nature, and it's our natural playground. The only thing I'm going to add, another cautionary note, I hate to be a scientist here,
That's all right. I have to do it every so often.
But we don't have a lot of the brain research to really nail these things, nor do we really have, I was just reviewing the creativity research that we can say being in this environment or in that context really increases brain growth or increases creativity. I think we have some really good guesses. And I couldn't agree more, Gail, that having environments that reduce stress today may be one of the biggest things we can do. And that certainly is a plus, whether you're in a nature preschool or whether you're in a natural home environment that is nurturing and loving and provides good social relationships. I just want us to be cautious about throwing around some of the neuroscience that I don't know that we're as sure about yet.
Fair enough. About a minute before I have to say a goodbye. And actually, Kathy, I'm going to go back to you only because you said something during the break about Skype and grandparents and children. I just want to give you a chance to weigh in on that.
Got to do it as a new grandparent. I did do a study on Skype because I wondered if a lot of the digital is taking us away from interactions with kids. And as grandparents, our kids live far away. What's happening with Skype? And I wondered, is Skype more like TV or is Skype more like that interaction and the conversational duets we were talking about? And I'm happy to tell you, it's more like those conversational duets. We really do respond to children and in a way that helps grow language.
Well, we could go on. I see a lot of people that want to join the conversation, but the clock is telling me we have to end the hour. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. The Lefkowitz Faculty Fellow in the Psychology Department at Temple University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And Gail Farmer, thank you so much for coming by as well.
My pleasure. Thanks for having
me. You're very welcome. Director of Education at the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And a reminder to our callers, if you want to be part of the conversation, don't call at 5 of the hour, okay? Fair enough. I'm Marty Moscow, and thanks so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.